Why did the U.S. end up bombing Iran? U.S. and Israeli leaders said it was because Iran was about to build a nuclear weapon, but many analysts, including those in the U.S. intelligence community, don't believe that to be true. Nader Hashimi is an associate professor of Middle East and Islamic politics and the director of the Al-Waleed Center for Muslim-Christian Understanding at Georgetown University. KGVM contributor David Rosenberg spoke with him about what was behind the attack on Iran.
Why now? Why would the U.S. choose to pick this moment to bomb Iran? Was it just a matter of political opportunity, or was it just that Netanyahu managed to convince Trump that now was the right time? What's going on there?
Yeah, I think both of those things. I think fundamentally, the U.S.-Israeli bombing of Iran at this moment was a byproduct of political opportunity. In other words, Iran right now is incredibly weak as a state, as a country, as a political system. It's lost most of its regional allies, Hezbollah, particularly Hamas. And it's a country.
Has it lost them, or are they just a little decimated right now?
Well, they're decimated. You know, I think they're not going to recover anytime soon. I mean, what Israel is doing in Gaza has really broken the back of Hamas, but I don't think they're down and out forever. But their ability to sort of, you know, project Iranian power has been limited. I think this whole discussion and the framing in the United States that Hamas is a proxy of Iran sort of completely distorts what's actually going on with Hamas. It's more of an Israel-Palestine phenomenon. It's not like Iran has created Hamas and, you know, pulls the strings.
But or any Hezbollah, more than the Houthis, yeah.
Any more than the Houthis, exactly. Yeah. You know, they're responding to particular local contexts. But I think Hezbollah is the big story here in terms of Iran's weakening regional power, because in Iran's national security doctrine, support for Hezbollah was very much predicated on using them in a crisis moment such as the one that we just witnessed, that if ever there was an American or Israeli attack, Iran hoped that Hezbollah could come to its rescue by opening up a second front. That's no longer an option because of what happened last summer. So they're not out of the picture, but they're severely weakened. And so economically, Iran is, you know, a very weak country. It's been under heavy sanction really for the last 45 years, but increasingly since Trump came to power in the first term of his presidency, and he tore up the Iran nuclear agreement and imposed very heavy sanctions. It's a weak country economically. It has a young population that aspires for more freedoms and a repressive regime that rules over them. And so I think emboldened by what Israel and the United States were able to pull off in other theaters in the Middle East, there was this sense that, look, we need to press ahead. And as Netanyahu said in the New York Times, rewrite the map of the Middle East.
Kind of like Bush Cheney wanted to do with the,
exactly. Very similar to that. Yeah. Very similar to that. In fact, after Hezbollah was crushed, I was in Washington D.C. at the time and I was following the debate. There was huge enthusiasm across the political spectrum that this is a wonderful thing for the United States in particular. And Israel is proving its worth as a reliable sort of ally in the region, because it's doing things that we want to do but we can't do for domestic reasons, for economic reasons.
So kind of ignoring the whole humanitarian crisis and the civilian deaths.
Completely. Yeah. Exactly. As if that's a price that's worth paying. Who cares about, you know, okay, 50,000, 100,000 Palestinians die. That doesn't really impact our geostrategic thinking of the Middle East. Israel is, you know, and there was actually comparisons to the famous Sykes-Picot arrangement that shaped the modern state of the Middle East, that was happening right now. And Israel was basically redrawing the political map. And at the time, that was last summer. Now that these, you know, Iranian allies were defeated, we need to press ahead and go after Tehran. And so I think what happened, if you follow the debate, Trump was committed to negotiation. But when negotiations started to, you know, predictably hit difficulty, instead of doubling down on negotiations and compromising, Netanyahu was able to convince Trump that let us hit Iran and we can soften them up a bit, and that will help you at the negotiating table down the road. But I think fundamentally, from a strategic perspective, from a military perspective, the view was that Iran sort of plays a unique role in the region as an obstacle to American and Israeli policy. And if we can get rid of that government, or at least severely weaken it, this would be a net gain for American interest, Israeli interest, the interest of Arab dictators, all of who are aligned, you know, in this, you know, arrangement known as the Abraham Accords. And it would be a net gain for, you know, Western and Israeli interests. And so, you know, that's fundamentally, I think, what the calculus was. And I have to say, in the short term, that has been accomplished, because, you know, if we just saw, if Iran was so weak, it couldn't protect its most senior military officials, its nuclear scientists. It didn't even have control over its own air force, which also challenges the narrative that we've been exposed to, that Iran was this hegemonic power taking over the Middle East. You know, if it was so hegemonic and so powerful, how did it sort of collapse relatively quickly?
Although they do have the power to strike back.
They have the power to strike back, but increasingly, you know, that's all they really had. And Israel was hitting those, you know, military, the missile launchers quite effectively. So yeah, it hasn't been completely down and hasn't been completely sort of shattered or broken yet. So I think that's fundamentally the calculation that, in terms of the why now question. And in the piece that I wrote in The Guardian, I sort of draw an analogy to, you know, the Cold War in Latin America, where for those of us who are old enough, we recall that everything in Latin America, in terms of its security situation back then during the Cold War, particularly during the Reagan era, was blamed on, you know, Cuba and then Nicaragua, as if they were the countries
that were responsible.
Or the Soviet
Union, for that matter.
And then the Soviet Union orchestrating everything, right? Mm-hmm. It was like, it was the Soviet Union, and then it was those countries. But of course, that was always a gross exaggeration. It was an easy way of sort of explaining the politics of the of that region. And the reason why, you know, Cuba was blamed, because Cuba was, you know, challenging American interests in the region in the same way that Iran is challenging, you know, Western interests in the Middle East.
And what about the calculation that some are making that the population will rebel against the regime even as the country is being bombed? What do you make of that?
I think it's complete fantasy. It reflects, I think, a complete misunderstanding of internal Iranian politics and even understanding of how political change takes place. I don't know of any case where you know, change a regime by bombing it from the air. I think what's actually going to happen is the exact reverse of these aspirations for regime change. The regime is actually going to get strengthened because it's going to play the nationalism flag. It's going to invoke powerful themes that are foundational to the identities of not just Iranians and people in the Middle East, but throughout the global South. The identities of these people in the global South were deeply shaped by the struggle for independence and decolonization. I mean, I could go through the whole history here, but in the case of Iran, Iran was severely affected. Its political development was severely affected by Western intervention, most prominently in 1953 when the United Kingdom and the United States, you know, intervened to topple Iran's best chance for democracy. And so that's a theme that's going to be invoked and exploited by the regime. And the other, I think, you know, element here is that, you know, the people who are calling for regime change in this moment are deeply unsavory and unscrupulous characters. You know, Benjamin Netanyahu and, you know, Donald Trump, you know, are not known for their moral virtue and commitment to human rights and democracy. So it's very difficult to sort of sign on to that project, given the people who are promoting this, you know, idea. So I think when you put it all together, it's actually going to set back the internal struggle for democracy in Iran. And that's just not my personal opinion. Listen to all those heroic Iranian dissidents and activists who are in Iran, who've been in and out of jail. They're saying the exact same things that I'm saying, that this war is actually going to be a net setback for their struggle. The regime is going to now crack down, I think, very heavily on civil society, using the excuse of a national security crisis in the name of going after Mossad agents to, you know, round up and kill anyone, because we do know that Mossad agents heavily penetrated Iran. So I think we're going to see very soon a dark period of further repression within the Islamic Republic of Iran. And a big reason for that is these recent attacks.
Aren't there governments in that area looking at this situation, the U.S. coming in very heavy with Israel and thinking, you know, they could do that to us if they want? And then, you know, then there's the whole Turkish angle. They must not be too happy about U.S. power in the Middle East to that extent.
No, I think the lesson from these countries, particularly if they're countries that have an independent foreign policy or they're not under they're not within the U.S.-Israeli orbit. My advice to Turkey right now, of course, I'm not a fan of the government there because it's authoritarian, but you better get a nuclear weapon, because if Israel is successful against Iran and crushes it, Turkey is next. And in fact, if you listen to the debate within Israel, there's actually talk of this, that Turkey will then be the next sort of regional obstacle to Israel's desire to be the hegemon.
Even though it's a NATO member.
Even though it's a NATO member, right? It's a NATO member. I mean, that poses problems, obviously, for Israel. But I think the net takeaway for many countries around the world is that if you have a nuclear weapon like North Korea does, you're protected. If you don't, like Iran, you can be invaded and bombed. And I think that also has, and I predict we'll see this very soon, the only natural logical step for the Iranian regime is to pull out of the non-proliferation treaty and try and get a nuclear weapon as quickly as possible because of what just happened. And in fact, if you follow the internal Iranian debate, as I had, when Obama sought to pursue a diplomatic path with Iran, hardliners in Iran were saying, look, we can't trust the United States. Let's just stand firm. Let's not compromise our nuclear program. Let's develop, you know, a nuclear capability because we might need it. You can't, you know, you can't, we can't risk the, you know, the security of our country. There was an internal debate. The pragmatists, the reformists won out. There was a nuclear deal that was struck. Iran was adhering to it. And it was precisely Donald Trump, at the encouragement of Netanyahu, who tore up that agreement. And internally within Iran, the consequence of that event in 2018 was that the hardliners pointed to the pragmatists, to the reformists, and said, see what you've done to us. You compromised our nuclear program, which was advanced. We have no protection now. We're under heavy sanction. And as a result of what's happened over the last 12 days, anyone in Iran who tries to sort of say we need to have diplomacy with the United States will be laughed at, you know, because ironically, you know, the United States and Iran were in the middle of diplomatic negotiations when Israel bombed and the United States gave the green light. So there's going to be no appetite for diplomacy anymore. There's going to be a strong appetite within the regime and within society for becoming a nuclear weapons state, because that's going to be the only way you can protect yourself. And people are going to point to North Korea as evidence, and Pakistan and other countries. And so ironically, the claim that, you know, the United States and Israel have weakened or taken out Iran's nuclear program will have the exact opposite effect.
And then there's the astounding fact that nobody in the Western media pays much attention to the fact that Israel has nuclear weapons.
That's a great point. And you know, there's been discussion of a nuclear weapons free zone in the Middle East for a very long time. Iran has strongly supported it. Israel has not. And the reason for that is because in the international system, you know, if you're on the home team, there's double standards that apply to you. To put it in another way, the West doesn't have a problem with nuclear weapons in the Middle East. They have a problem with nuclear weapons being in the hands of their adversaries, not their friends. And that's just a fundamental principle. The other related point is that the argument is that, look, we can't trust this, you know, brutal regime in Iran with nuclear weapons because look at their human rights record. Well, let's apply that same principle to Israel and its human rights record as an apartheid state.
Well, they have to defend themselves against terrorism.
So, I mean, those arguments no longer hold anymore. So I think this is a, you know, I think that I actually think this is a defining moment for the region. I think things are going to get much uglier rather than better. And so I'm very worried about, you know, what comes next.
But you don't think it'll end up as what you might call the Christian Zionist wet dream, where the apocalypse happens and they're waiting for the second coming, that kind of thing?
Obviously, some people in the MAGA coalition actually, you know, are motivated by that particular narrative. I don't think Trump is, because you know he's fundamentally secular, but he plays that card to get their support. But I think there's certainly, you know, that type of messianic sort of cult of thinking in the MAGA coalition and within Netanyahu's coalition in a different way, though, that sort of are driving these political decisions. So it's a dark moment.
That's Georgetown University Associate Professor Nader Hashemi speaking with KGVM contributor David Rosenberg. This interview was released on July 1st, 2025.